I would never camp. I mean, you're outside. There's bugs. You have to like use the bathroom in the woods. It's probably loud. I just want to be clear. I've actually never camped.
We're back with season two of the Behavioral Design Podcast. Aline, we're back. How do you feel?
I'm so excited. We have an incredible lineup this season. We have some real behavioral science superstars, and not to name drop.
I was going to say, can you name drop some?
I'll do a couple. You know, really everyone is fantastic, but I will name drop Katie Milkman. I'm sure you're familiar with her. Dan Ariely. I'm very sure you're familiar with him, and many, many more.
Yeah, I'm also super excited. It's kind of a challenge for us to improve on the first season. I think we had a good start there, but I definitely feel like we're taking another leap with this season. So yeah, can't wait to share all of what we have in store for you guys.
And if you love us as much as we love you, we have a favor to ask you.
Yes, please head to Apple Podcast and leave us a review. It's a great way to support a podcast beyond sharing it with your friends, family, your mom, whoever you think will enjoy it.
Your grandma. I always share with my grandma, and she is probably our biggest fan. I don't know if I've told you this, Sam, but she listens to every single episode.
Is this true?
She loves it.
Is this true?
It is true. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
Yeah. I'm not kidding. It's fantastic.
We should have her on at some point.
You know, I'm sure she would be up for that.
Amazing. Yeah. So that's a great way to support us. And without further ado, let's get in to the first episode of season two. Who are we speaking with today?
Well, I'm very excited to share our guest today is Emily Oster. She's an econ professor at Brown. Emily is the author of Crib Sheet, Expecting Better. And most excitingly, her newest book, The Family Firm, is out today. And, you know, we talk about this book a bit in our interview with her. I'm a huge fan of all of her books. They're sort of like the Cliff's Notes to parenting. And one thing that I'm not sure I want to admit, I was actually reading her books before ever becoming a parent. They're that entertaining that they appeal to literally everyone. And the thing I like best about her writing is that she just distills all of the research for you. You don't have to go out and read all the randomized controlled trials about whether you can eat sushi or not during pregnancy and so on. She does all of that for you. So it's really like giving you the Cliff's Notes.
Yeah, no, she's amazing. And I think we'll get introduced to her work in different ways. So I actually found her through Twitter because I just realized that she was the best person to follow for all data relating to COVID and understanding how to make good decisions in a crazy world. And so that's how I got into following her work. And then obviously we felt like we had to bring her on for all of these reasons. And so in this episode, we get into obviously her fantastic book that's out today, The Family Firm, and the four Fs, which is her framework to pretty much help you as a parent, or I would honestly say even non-parent, to make good decisions at home and to really leverage the data you have in a thoughtful and productive way to make it a little bit easier in the crazy life we have outside of work as well. So we talk as well about salience of risk and how that can impact decision making, which has been something really, really salient in the past year or so. we get into science communication and how to do it well and where public health officials often go wrong. And one thing that I guess we both find interesting is that listening to this episode, you might learn how you can tell that someone is an economist without knowing that they're an economist through language like ex ante and ex post. And lastly, very importantly, apparently, I'm still not really sure what this means, but apparently the most important thing in the summer is to have a somersault swimmer. Is that true? Yeah.
It's true. Our listeners get it, even if you don't, Sam.
Okay, let's hope so. Well, let's get into the episode. Let's get it started.
Heavens to Murgatroyd.
Oh, ho.
Well, Emily, it's an incredible honor to have you on the show. I think I literally jumped for joy when you agreed to chat with us. I don't want to say that I'm your biggest fan because that would be pretty weird, but some other people might say that about me.
Well, I'm very excited you guys called, and I'm excited to talk with you.
And I actually have a confession. If it weren't for you, I probably wouldn't have had a baby in the first place. Your advice really helped
me. Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah. And here I am with a 5-month-old. And
I feel like at a 5-month-old, like maybe you're going to tell me like, and I hate you. and you're the worst.
It's definitely whenever he's difficult, we blame you. Yeah. Damn that, Emily. Yeah, and certainly I hope that you keep publishing as the years go on, because I'm following behind you. So I assume the next book is going to be teenagers, and we're going to work our way all the way up to, I don't know, grandparenting. How to grandparent. I will need that someday.
I hope so.
Yeah, awesome. So with that, let's jump right in.
Yeah, I guess we want to start with something which is interesting, especially asking you, because obviously it's been a very strange and for many disorienting 18 months or so, where it is to feel like we've had to update our beliefs on almost a daily basis. And we obviously all learned new things about ourselves and the world, but I feel like you've really been one of the amazing people on, call it like, the front lines, doing an amazing job of kind of gathering information and helping people make sense of all of this data coming in on a literally daily basis. So the first question for you really is there anything unexpected that you've learned about human behavior from the pandemic?
Oh my goodness. So I think that I had not understood how important salience was in people's understanding of risk. So for me, when I sort of think back on the last 18 months and I try to organize some of the ways that people interact with risk and that they think about risk and that they have framed their choices, the thing that jumps out at me is, particularly around kids, how much people have reacted to COVID in a way that reflects a very different attitude towards risk than other places that in their lives. And I think, as I have reflected on why that is, I think there's a really important role for salience and the idea that this risk is the thing you're thinking about. And that's something that determines our behavior all the time, I think now. I think that's true. But it is rare that some particular stimulus is salient so frequently for so long, right? And so I think this has kind of been a thing which has just been on our minds for so long. And it's therefore I've gotten to see how important that factor is in determining behavior. And it's changed the way a lot of how I've started to think about how people process risks, which is a topic that I've been interested in a long time, but has kind of, I've thought about differently now.
Yeah, very interesting. And you might think that the salience in the beginning of the pandemic was maybe due to the novelty, or like, this is a very unfamiliar kind of risk. But then as we got used to it, it was just the one risk that we thought about all the time, whereas compared to other risks that we're just really accustomed to taking. And, you know, we have these norms around, like, I think the example that often comes up is just driving your car. There's a like pretty big risk involved in driving your car that we don't even think twice about. But then when it comes to going to a birthday party and, you know, wearing a mask or not, this is like suddenly all-consuming kind of risk.
Yeah. And I think that people, you know, I think it actually interacts in an interesting way with people's poor understanding and poor ability to process probability, like small probabilities. And that, you know, if you sort of think about the way that we process small probabilities, I think we have a kind of simplification in our head, which is sort of like, there's kind of a thing that's small, but not zero. And then there's zero. I think a lot of times when we think about driving or something like that, we kind of just think of it as zero. We've sort of like rounded it down. But once we accept that it's some risk, we can kind of only understand it as a kind of, this happens sometimes, like kind of risk. And sometimes is like pretty different from zero. And I think there's like something in there that's sort of around in my head as a result of watching this play out over the last 18 months.
And where do you think you fall in terms of your own risk tolerance? So, you know, and I guess, how do you think that's changed over the course of the pandemic? So maybe you thought of yourself, for example, as, you know, having a certain tolerance for risk or a certain risk aversion before you saw all of this, you know, the effect of all the salience and other people's risk taking before the pandemic. And then how did that change over time now? Do you think maybe you think of yourself as being less risk averse now relative to others?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I would have ex ante said that I was a person with like a pretty high level of risk aversion and that I was a pretty cautious person. I think in a lot of ways that's true. I think that the way I have interfaced with the pandemic, a lot of people would say, you know, wow, you were willing to take a lot of risks that I wasn't willing to take. You know, I sent my kids to in-person camp, in-person school, you know, last summer, all year this year. And, you know, that reflected partly a sort of particular view about the size of the risk from that particular activity. But I think partly a kind of view about really how, a risk aversion or an ability, a desire to sort of accept some kinds of risks that I think were different than others. And you know, I'm not sure how much of it is risk and how much of it is sort of the way that I weighed, you know, different benefits. But I definitely think I have changed my view of where I fall in the risk aversion space over the last year.
Yeah, maybe your absolute risk tolerance has stayed about the same and everyone else has gotten much more risk averse.
That is possible.
And what do you think about, is there any traits or anything that people who are good at having somewhat of an accurate risk preference or tolerance has? Do you notice any tendencies? Or
I think we're all very poor at this. Like, this is not something that one evolves, like should really evolve to do. You know, thinking about, well, this activity is a 1 in 80 million risk and this activity is 1 in 200,000 risk. And like, of course, those are totally different, but they're both in the realm of things that we don't interact with very frequently. And I think, you know, for me, a lot of the last year has been just thinking about different ways to help people understand small risks with different kinds of language. And so I experiment with a lot of different ways of kind of how do I explain to people, you know, the risk of getting COVID from this activity is, you know, 1 in 20,000. Like, what is the right way to say that? Is the right way to say it's like this risk of this other thing? Is the right way to say if you did this thing, you know, 5 times a day, this is how many years it would take you to get COVID? Like, this is when you would expect to get COVID. So I've just like experimented with a lot of things like that because I think that none of us are very good at small probabilities. And I would include, by the way, myself in that. So, you know, I spent all this time writing about this saying that like everything is, you know, that like it's okay and the case rates are low and, you know, we should be willing to do things. And so then the other day, my husband was like, you know, let's take the kids to a restaurant. And, you know, there's this like place and we'd have to eat inside and our kids are not vaccinated. But the case rates where I live are really low. They're like 2 in 100,000, you know, in a given day is like 10 cases in Rhode Island. Well, it's not very big, but, you know, there's not 9 people here, you know? So, and it's just like very low. And I was like, I don't know if I'm ready. And he was like, do you hear what's coming out of your mouth? Like, that's crazy. Like, work it out. And then of course I worked it out and I was like, okay, you're right. But it was still like, it was still hard to sort of think about that, even though that's all I do for the entire day. We went to the restaurant. It was great. It was amazing.
It. Tapas. Great. Do you think that this difficulty in translating the risk into something that's intelligible for most people is part of the reason that we get such poor recommendation from, for example, our healthcare providers or, you know, public health experts and that they just haven't figured out that they're doing a poor job of communicating?
I think there's a few things that that influence that poor communication. I think it is very poor. And I think the pandemic showed how poor it is. I think one is, as you say, that it's difficult to find the right language to talk about small risks. I think a second issue is that there is a strong desire when giving public health advice to say what to do, and that people expect to hear that, and they don't expect to hear, here's how to think about it. They expect to hear, here's the decision to make. And so much of what I do is, here's how to think about it. And, you know, if you're just going to say, here's the decision to make, then you kind of need to assume something about people's risk tolerance and kind of say, okay, well, I've like assuming this thing about your risk tolerance, here's the thing, the decision that you should take. And that seems to be the messaging that we often do, not just in COVID, but in all of the spaces that I think about. But of course, if people don't have the same risk tolerance, then that isn't a very good approach to messaging. So I think that's another thing. And I think the other set of issues here is, you know, not unrelated, but public health messaging really does not want to acknowledge uncertainty. they don't want to acknowledge that we don't really know. And that's not exactly the same as not wanting to acknowledge different people would do different things. But it is, it's related that you don't want to say, look, our best guess is the right thing to do is this, but we're not sure. And here's the information that we're waiting for. Here's where the gaps are in our knowledge. There's just absolutely no appetite to say things like that at all.
And I wonder how much of it is also just not trusting people's ability to make the right decision. So if you, for example, tell pregnant women, you know, this is how many drinks you can have. Is it that they're afraid, you know, you might not actually be able to drink in moderation and therefore it's just nothing, you know, the recommendation is zero.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that there's a huge amount of sort of lack of trust paternalism in this space that you want to tell people, you know, it's, as I talk about, there's a concept in Judaism of sort of draw a fence around the law, that if you don't want to, if you want people to not do something, if you're really sure that they shouldn't do something, you want to draw the guidance much broader than that so they don't get anywhere near the something. And I think there's an element of that, which is that, you know, if you don't want people to drink too much, rather than just saying, you know, here is the amount that, you know, we think would be safer, here's how to think about it, they just say, you know what, we're going to sort of draw a very broad fence around this so we don't get anywhere close to that. But I think there are some problems with that messaging in these spaces.
Great. Yeah, I think it'd be nice to take a step back now and get into a segue towards talking about your books, because you've written some fantastic books. And to start us off, I guess it would be interesting to hear a little bit more about why you wrote them. Like, what is it that you hoped they would bring to the discussion? Or what do you hope would be different with these books being in the world?
Yeah, so I think there's kind of two things that I'm trying to add with the books that I think are missing from some of this discussion. So one is like almost like kind of translation. So there's kind of an expert like scientific consensus around some thing, but when we express that out to people, we very rarely try to translate why we think that. And so there's like, I did a meta-analysis and the answer is X. But for many people, they would like to understand why you came to that conclusion. And of course, there are pieces of that, which is sometimes the reason you came to that conclusion is because you're using bad data. And so some of what I do in the books is be like, hey, some of these conclusions don't make any sense because people don't understand, like, because data is bad. Fine. Mm-hmm. But even if the data is good, there's still this piece of like, okay, well, you need to tell people why, because that's going to help them understand why they should do something. It's going to help them organize in their heads why we have some of the restrictions we do, why we make the choices we do, which of these things are most important. You know, which, like, is it most important to not smoke or is it most important to not have a cup of coffee? You've said I shouldn't do either of those things. Turns out one of them is far worse than the other. But, you know, you just told me don't do all this stuff. Like, I don't know what, I just not do any of the things.
Yeah.
I think that's like a big piece of what I'm bringing with the books. And I think the other thing, and this kind of sort of is more salient, more important in the Family Firm, which is out now, I guess, based on when
today,
this
time, yeah.
Today, okay, it's out today, is sort of bringing in a piece of decision-making and bringing in a piece of the idea that you know, when we come out with results in science, we rarely frame it inside, you know, how should you make decisions differently based on this? And a lot of the tools I'm trying to give people are how can you kind of combine decision-making with some of these pieces of data to incorporate them in your life rather than just be like, okay, I don't know what to do with this. You know, you told me coffee is good or coffee is not good. And like, where am I putting that in my space?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point about helping people with that narrative of, you know, why should I not do X, Y, Z so that they can actually think through it rather than, you know, just the, here's the recommendation and, you know, are all of them weighed equally. I want to talk a little bit about the approach of sharing this kind of information with people to help them make better decisions. Of course, a lot of behavioral science goes into, you know, how do we you know, change environments to help people make better decisions? How do we you know, influence their heuristics and biases and all of these other ways that we know people make decisions outside of just consuming information and all of these other sort of, you know, forces and influences? How do you sort of mesh these together, this information-based, you know, giving people good information to incorporate into their decision-making processes and all of these other things that are influencing them at the same time? Are you competing with this other aspect of decision-making, or like, how do you tease these apart?
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of my academic work of late is about sort of like diet and how you can't change people's diet. And so, you know, if you want to do anything, you just got to like have some external, you know, force and people, and information is not helpful. Right. So I have these whole papers that are like telling people information about stuff doesn't help. And then I'm like, read my book. It's about information. I think there is sort of a big gap between the kinds of behaviors where there's a sort of default and we're trying to change what we're doing as opposed to we're not doing anything and we need to choose what thing to do. And I think a lot of the kind of stuff that I deal with in the books is in the space of, okay, I have never done this before. Like this is the first time I'm pregnant. It's the first time I have a baby. It's the first time I'm choosing a school. There's no like default, I love Doritos. You know, there's no like every day Doritos are amazing. That's what I'm doing. I got to change. It's like, I never did this before. And so that's when I think you kind of get people to be better able to use information because there isn't another choice or there's some way they have to make that decision and, you know, pitching like, okay, here is a way to make this decision. You didn't have a way. So here is a way that you could use. You got to use some way. Let's use a way that is sort of in a good decision-making space. We then have a whole other set of things where people are already doing things in a way. Maybe that way is not right or is not the way they would most like to do it, but it's really hard to change because it's kind of a habit. And that's where I think a lot of the stuff that comes out of behavioral science is sort of interesting for trying to make some of those choices. And for me, all like diet is like the most salient thing. It's like the thing I think about all the time in that space. Yeah. But of course, there's other places that you can nudge.
You mentioned The Family Firm, fantastic book. I read it it felt like maybe not one sitting, but I wanted to do it in one sitting because it was very, very good. And one of the main premises is that, you know, we don't really have a problem of taking an organized, systematic approach to decision-making at work, but we really fail to do the same in the context of the home and using some of the same tools at home. And you argue in some ways that we should treat our personal family decisions a little bit more like we treat business decisions. So why do you think, first of all, these environments brings out so different kind of decision-making or behavior from us? I think you give some great examples in the book where, for example, we're quite unlikely at home to maybe use Google Calendar with our kids. And we might be much likely to kind of micromanage our partner at home when it comes to snack selection than we do micromanaging a colleague at work for some minor tasks. So what do you think there's the kind of this big shift in behavior or decision-making?
I think there's a couple of things. So one is I just think that this isn't this is sort of not the way we're socialized into running our households. And so when you arrive at work, they tell you here's the way we're doing it. But when you kind of arrive in a household, we don't sort of have that to begin with. But I think there's something deeper underlying, which is that when you are at your home with the people that you love, there is a temptation to think, well, because I love these people, it should just kind of work. Like I shouldn't have to like sit down and have a meeting with my spouse about how we're going to organize our life because we love each other. We're just going to like make it work together, you know? And I think some of these tools, when I talk about this with people, I talk about, you know, well, you could have shared Google Docs and you could send each other follow-up emails about the meeting to make sure people are like, who are you married to? Like what?
Another economist.
another economist, you know, it's good. But I do think that that because of that feeling like this is so impersonal, people have been reluctant to adopt some of these tools. And I think there's a little bit of a shift maybe that could be useful to make to say, hey, like I can have a happy, loving, emotionally rich relationship with these people and also use Google Forms. And that may not be in as much conflict as we think. And that in fact, I may be able to have a nicer relationship with this person if I'm not always resentful about why they aren't doing things the way that I said, even though I never told them actually that those things were important to me because we didn't have enough Google Docs.
Yeah, I can say one quick thing about, I have so two friends, one of them is a behavioral scientist as well. And they got into conflict based on him sending a Calendly link for them to catch up. And he sent her a Calendly link and she's like, who am I to you? Like, why would you send me a Calendly link? Like, this is not supposed to be this way between friends. Have you come across similar kind of reactions?
Yeah, I mean, I think people do have this reaction. And so sometimes I will explain. I think it's one thing with your friends, I think it's even a sort of a further step with your spouse. And, you know, I will explain to people, I mean, this is, you know, like when Jesse and I are trying to work through something, like frequently we will have a conversation about it and then he will send a follow-up email. In our conversation, we agreed on the following bullet points. Let me know if I'm missing anything. Love, Jesse. And, you know, I explain to other people and then they're, at first, sometimes they're like, what? What is that? But then you say, you know, well, why is that valuable? Well, then later, like, if there's something that I've missed in the conversation, I can be like, oh, hey, I don't think that isn't how I remember that. I thought we said this. And then it's not that I do something different and later you yell at me or I yell at you. It just generates a kind of common efficiency knowledge that lets us sort of move forward in making better decisions in these spaces. And then sometimes when I explain that to people and then they reflect a little bit, like, actually, that doesn't sound as terrible as I thought it did when you first said it. So that's it. I'm just like getting in there with people. And I think once they try it, they'll really like it.
Eventually we'll all be scheduling.
We're all going to be scheduling meetings with our kids through Google Calendar.
One thing I wanted to ask you as well in terms of decision-making is how you think about decision-making, even in firms, so to say, where it seems like there's kind of this bigger wave in general that it just seems that, surprise, surprise, we're bad at decision-making, not only at home, but also even at the highest level of, you know, governance or at businesses and so on. How good are firms, do you think, at making decisions?
I mean, I think they vary a lot, right? I mean, I think that you know, I sort of talk about this in the book, like there's some kind of like platonic ideal of like the firm with the structured decision-making. And you know, I think it is true that firms have better processes generally. Mm. You know, there's generally kind of the idea that you would have calendars that's like more normal. But I think when we talk about processes for decision-making, there's a fair amount of heterogeneity in how good firms are at this. And I do think that there's, you know, that there are definitely firms where the way that they make decisions is not actually the way you would want to have decisions made. So maybe they should read this too.
Everyone can benefit.
Everyone can benefit from my book. That's it.
Also in the book, you present sort of a framework, the four Fs for helping with some of the medium-sized decisions. Could you give us the sort of two-sentence version of the four Fs, which of course are framing the question, fact-finding, coming up with a final decision, and then following up.
Yes, and the idea here is to give people a framework and a way to think about these medium-sized decisions and to kind of structure the decision-making. And the reason for this, I think, is that decisions like this, you know, what school should we pick or even sort of smaller things, should we do this activity, tend to kind of take over people's brains and then they take all the space, but you never find the moments to really focus on them. And that is not a good way to make decisions. So the idea here is to say, hey, for these decisions, you really do need some focused time, but you also don't need all the time. And here is the kind of walking through it. And I think that I know I've went over my two sentences, okay. But I will say, I think the sort of most important pieces of this are the beginning and the sort of first and third, the idea that you actually want to make sure you are asking a concrete answerable question with multiple alternatives, but not infinity alternatives. And that at the end, you kind of make a decision about it and you don't just let it sort of trickle on. So I think those are kind of the key things I think people sometimes miss, even though they seem really obvious when you say them.
Yeah. Well, I think the first and third are probably, from a process perspective, the most important in terms of what, you know, how people are making the decision themselves. But I actually find the second one of fact-finding to be, you know, especially helpful in terms of where your work has sort of come in. I think that one thing that you do really, really well, probably better than anyone I can think of, is just, you know, diving into the literature on any topic, interpreting all of the studies, you know, taking into account the quality of the research, you know, is the, you know, the general finding that we come out of this, is it just based on correlation or, you know, what sort of causal inferences can we make from this? And then we're just summarizing it in these bite-sized morsels, you know, going back to that translation of research and giving it back to people. I think that's sort of one thing that you do really well. But this fact-finding step actually incorporates other sort of personal criteria that people bring to the table as well. So some of the things that you cover are, you know, what's your budget? How much time do you have? What are the logistics involved? You know, do you have to, you know, drive to six different places and you can't be in more than, you know, one at the same time? You know, does it fit with this family mission and so on? And So what are your thoughts on this combined approach in general, this sort of meshing together of data and preference? Do you think that by pulling these two together, that will help people make more rational decisions or better decisions? I know you don't use the language of rationality, or you don't tend to, but yeah, how do you think about that?
I mean, I think that this is kind of the big challenge of this part of parenting that was hard when I was thinking about writing this book. So, you know, this piece about what does the data say about question X, that is very nice of you to say that I'm good at it, is the thing that I love. Like the idea of like digging into a literature and being like, what do we know about sleep? Like, let's get into like, how much do people need and how do we know it? And what do the studies say? Like it's the funnest for me. It's like so great. And how do I explain it to people? It's just like the greatest thing. And a lot of the first two books, that's kind of what there is. It's like, okay, you know, I'm going to tell you what the data says. And then, you know, in Crib Sheet, when I write about little kids, there's a little bit of framing around that about, you know, how do you think about the effect sizes and the decisions? But a lot of it is really the data. The data kind of tells you enough. And part of why I was initially very resistant to writing a book about older kids in this age range, is that it is almost never the case that the data is enough. There are so many logistics and family preferences and heterogeneity across kids and things like that that wrap around that. And so you would never be able to say, or very, very rare in one of these decisions, would you be able to say, once I see this piece of data, I am able to make the decision about doing this without seeing anything else. So the approach in the book is really to say, look, there is this data and here's a bunch of stuff in the book where I can tell you something about that data and you can use it and you can use some of these facts. And hopefully some of this is kind of interesting to read just on its own, but you'll then need these other pieces. But these other pieces aren't something nebulous, like how do I feel about it? A lot of them are also really practical facts, like, hey, what does my schedule look like? If my kids do these two activities 2 hours away from each other at the same time on Thursday, someone will need to drive each of them. That's it. And that's going to be part of your logistics. But it is a concrete thing that you can write down. So the insight, I think, a little bit in the book is to say, it's not just the data, it's this other piece, but this other piece isn't something that we can't wrangle. It's something we can wrangle in the same way. It's just a different kind of piece, and they sort of come together in this second step.
Awesome.
I'm curious, which one of these have you noticed that people find maybe least intuitive in terms of getting started with doing more or more thoughtfully doing these four steps? Which one do people struggle with most, it seems?
I think that people struggle a lot with framing questions. Mm. And when I talked about this a lot in COVID, actually also, it sort of had a version of this approach that I talked about a lot during COVID. And I think both there and in your general life, people have a very hard time saying what their alternatives are. It's very easy for us to say, should I do this or not? But it's much harder to say, should I do this or that? And we are often in situations in which there's no sort of like obvious default. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one piece it's not ultimately that it's hard for people to do. It's just that it didn't occur to them that would be helpful to do. And then the other piece, I think, is the like last step of this is called follow-up. And it points out that after you have made a decision, you should schedule a time to think about whether it was the right decision. And no one ever does that. We make a choice. It's like, oh, yeah, I made the choice. Like, I'm moving on, you know? And I think one of my sort of favorite things somebody told me, I think I put in the book, was this sort of an overheard conversation between some parents at a gym where it was like, everyone in my family hates doing gymnastics. Like the kids hate it and we hate it, but like, what else are you going to do? And it was sort of like, well, you should quit if everybody hates it. But inherent in there, this thing that's like, well, we decided to do gymnastics. I guess we're just doing it like all the time, as opposed to saying, hey, there's an opportunity. Every year you got to give in your money for the gymnastics. You could just not do that. And you should have a plan to decide if you want to not do that.
Yeah.
Well, now I think we should jump to a different kind of segment. What do you think, Sam? Is it time?
I think it's time.
Oh gosh, I feel like this setup suggests to me, I don't know what's going to be in this segment.
It's fun, I promise.
Okay. Oh, good. Yes. When podcast hosts say things are fun, almost always they turn out to be fun.
This is a segment that we call underrated, overrated. We will just shout some things at you and ask you to say whether you think it's underrated or overrated. And
all right.
Just very briefly why.
Okay.
Cool. Workbooks, overrated or underrated?
Underrated. I love a workbook and I think that we do not write down our thoughts enough.
Frozen.
Overrated. I'm done. I'm done with Frozen.
Oh, man. I have to say, you made a comment in the family firm about Elsa and Honey Marin. And so, of course, I had to Google this afterwards. And I confirmed, at least according to the internet, they will be dating in Frozen 3.
Nice. Yes.
I think this is the first.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's good. I like Honey Marin. She seemed like a nice lady. Yeah. I'm into it.
What about no phone zones?
What is a no phone zone?
So kind of limiting smartphone use by having certain places in your home or could be anywhere where you
like
don't
dinner.
Use them. Yeah.
Underrated. I think that we, this is, I mean, obviously I it's hard for me to rate something that I've only heard of just now. But I see the idea. And I think that this is something, these kind of rules are often pretty helpful because phones are addictive. And if we don't write rules, then it is easy for things to sort of slip. So I like the idea of some kind of rules. Phone zone seems like a reasonable one.
Quick question there. It seems like a little bit of a theme with this book, but also previous books is that a lot of the things that you preach is this idea that, okay, you set yourself up maybe for a little bit more work initially, but with certain things in place, save a lot of time of like in real time to make difficult decisions. Because kind of like you have these rules, like you, I think you mentioned in the book, at 6 o'clock, you're faced with the decision of should your daughter do a certain sport? And then you knew that, well, that's the time for dinner. So you could say no straight away, where otherwise you would have to make this big thing. You think in general that's a big thing that people kind of can take advantage of to make more of these heuristics in life or roles in life to support them?
Yeah, I think that there are a surprising number of situations in which having some kind of rules can make decisions easier in the moment. And particularly in parenting, actually, I think there's a lot of value because of the way we interact with our kids to having these kind of rules, because there's almost an externalization. Like, can I have this? Oh, I'm sorry. The rule is blah. Like, you know, can I have, like, one of my kids likes candy a lot. So there's like a lot of like, can I have this? Like, oh, I'm sorry. We have the following rule about that. So no, you know, and as opposed to being like, I don't want you to do that. It's like, I'm really sorry, but the rule.
The rule says so.
The rule said. So it's not really nothing I can do. It's out of my hands because of the rule. It's in a Google Doc. So I couldn't possibly, you know, works with your students too. It's like, can I have extra? I'm sorry. There's no regrading. It's in the syllabus. I couldn't go back on that.
Awesome. How about somersault bathing suits?
Underrated. Love a good somersault bathing suit. Somersault bathing suit, perfect for moms. I mean, other people can wear them too, but it's so great.
For people like me who don't know even what that is, like, can you talk a little bit more about
it? I don't think they make them it's a kind of bathing suit that moms, that ladies like. It's a great bathing suit.
Round of luck, Sam.
What I like about it is this looks so interesting is that this is sort of the somersault and then Lululemon are two places that I shop a lot. But both of them in the last couple of years have moved to having like a wider range of models in a way that I would have said ex ante, like who cares? Like why would that matter? But actually I find ex post really affects how I think about the whole landscape and how I shop. And so I that's something where I've been surprised at how much I think that matters to people.
Yeah, it's interesting when I hear the sort of the marketing language about connecting with brands, I just roll my eyes and I'm like, no one connects with brands. But then you see this and you're like, yeah, okay, I get that.
Yeah, I kind of do. Yeah. I feel like we lost Samuel on this one.
It's just very confused. Yes, very confused. We'll see how we go with this one. Optimism, overrated or underrated?
I think underrated. I tend to be a little bit of a like fake it till you make it kind of person on a lot of things. And I think that optimism has a little bit of that feature that, you know, if you are optimistic, sometimes it is easier to make good things happen.
Beautiful. Camping.
Overrated. I would never camp. I hate the idea of camping. Hate everything about it. No camping.
I was going to say, any reason for that? Any specific reason?
I mean, you're outside. There's bugs. You have to like use the bathroom in the woods. It's probably loud. I just want to be clear. I've actually never camped. But I feel it's so overrated that I have never even
considering it.
I don't like bugs.
Yeah, I feel you.
I'm not into bugs.
What about spell check?
I would say overrated because although my spelling is terrible, even though I carefully spell check everything, I almost always have a tremendous number of spelling mistakes in everything that I write because the same, you know, sometimes there's things where it is a word, even though that's not, it doesn't fix all your typos. And so I feel that it should be better, more like a copy editor, which I need as a person who can't spell at all. Terrible spelling.
Taylor Swift.
Underrated. I love Taylor Swift.
What's the most underrated album?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I just think that like her rating should be infinity. You know, I like her country stuff, like her early country stuff. I think that I wish she would do more of that.
Cool. I feel like this is one of the themes so far in the podcast, actually, that people, especially the guests that we bring on, seem to love Taylor Swift. I don't know if there's...
We only invite guests who love Taylor Swift.
I had her, the Evermore, which is like the second of the two things, albums that she released like during the pandemic. I just like, for whatever reason, I just started listening to, and I would listen to like every day when I was spraying my outdoor ice rink in the winter, which is like February was like kind of a dark, you know, kind of like a dark, cold time. And I would just like stand outside in like 10 degrees with my like ice rink sprayer and listen to Taylor Swift. And that was very calming.
Nice. So what about pregnancy, which obviously you covered in Expecting Better in the first book, that period?
Is it overrated or underrated?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's, I can't answer that one. I mean, I actually really liked being pregnant. I didn't like mind it, and it resulted in my kids. And so in that sense, I would say like one could not rate it highly enough, but you know, you do vomit a lot.
Right.
How about the next phase, sort of the crib sheet phase, the baby toddlers?
I would say underrated. I think people are too quick to talk about that phase as like, you know, you're exhausted and you know this.
I am exhausted.
Baby. Like you're tired and like they don't sleep and then they need you all the time and so on. But it is also like really magical in some ways. And kind of to watch somebody learn to do stuff is like it's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, it really is.
And then what about kind of the phase of family firm, as in kind of the age between 5 and 12?
I think I would say underrated. I cannot tell you how much I like this phase of my kids. You know, I think partly it's just very well suited to me. And, you know, there are so many features of having a kid who like can poop by themselves, but also still likes you, that are just like, for me, that's like so magical, right? Like they don't need the physical need dials down a little bit, but they don't hate you yet. And they want to like, you know, have you read them books. And then the books you can read them are not just, you know, Matt Sat, but actually are the books that you loved and you get to read again. I'm reading my daughter, The Golden Compass, like the Philip Pullman series. And it's like amazing to get to revisit something that you love so much as you know, through the eyes of somebody else.
Cool. Well, that's it for underrated, overrated. It wasn't so bad, right?
Wasn't so bad.
And we have one final question for you. What is one thing that you've changed your mind about? It can be anything in your life.
I change my mind all the time. So at some point I did change my mind about how much space there should be between my kids. That was like a thing that has had a big impact on my life. I think I thought we would do like pretty fast. And then it ended up, I changed my mind, not for any real database reason, but just because of like what sort of felt like it worked. And the kids are like 4 years apart.
My sister and I are 4 years apart.
I like it.
And for some reason, my mom told me, and I believe for a really long time, that was like the ideal amount of space. and truly believe
it's
that.
The hunter-gatherer spacing, right? It's like the point where the older one can carry their own backpack when you have a baby.
That's perfect. So it is ideal.
That's what you need. It is ideal. It's, yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
Can I sneak in one more question before we wrap up?
Go for it.
So you could say that it's based on the idea that, well, you being an economist might make you, you know, a better parent in some ways. But is there some certain ways being an economist make you a worse parent? Or like looking average on economists, is there any traits or anything that would make an economist a worse parent?
I feel like you should have my daughter on and ask her, like, what are all the problems with having me as a parent? You know, I do think, like, there is a tendency, I'm not sure how much this is economics is supposed to be, there's kind of a tendency to want to approach everything that is raised with, like, here is the solution. Like, okay, let's analyze it. Like, what's the cost and benefits? Like, you know, and I think there are problems where really the right approach to parenting is just to listen. And one of the things that's very nice about my older kid is she is very good at being like, actually, I'm not actually looking for you to fix this problem. I'm just going to tell you what it is. And like that, and you just like listen to it. And so I think that that's something that I have tried to learn. Mostly she's pretty helpful.
Awesome.
Well, that's all. Thanks so much for joining us today. Today's a really important day. Obviously, the Family Firm is out today. So if you know you listeners haven't already pre-ordered it, you should buy it right now before you're even done listening to this podcast. Emily, is there anything Absolutely. You want to say about the book before we log off?
No, I mean, there's a hardcover, there's a Kindle version, there's an audiobook, which I read. So if you listen to this and you were like, wow, I can't wait to hear more of this person's voice. You could hear the entire book read by me, and I hope people like it.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks for listening to the Behavioral Design Podcast from Habit Weekly and the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke University. Make sure to subscribe to the show. And if you like what we're doing here, don't forget to share it with your friend, a colleague, your mother, anyone you can think of. Our fantastic show music is Murgatroyd by the wonderful Dave Pizarro. And thanks to the team at Orange Wall Media for the production of this episode. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another deep dive into all things behavioral design.
Heavens to Murgatroyd. Oh, ho.
Blow.
Oh, ho. Is Emily Oster. She's an econ professor at Brown. You know by her twiddle.